Hello and welcome to episode 13 of the Warfighter podcast. Colin Hillier, good evening.
Hello. This month has been like a blur.
Yeah. Good things come to those that wait. And I apologize, listener, that you've had to wait so long for this final episode in series two, but it's definitely worth the wait.
We're not going to place blame with anyone for why this last one's tardy, but it, as you say, it's worth waiting for. Tell us a bit about who's coming on last.
Last but not least. So we've got chats with two people, which I think, again, are two avid listeners of the podcast and supporters of the podcast. And I think it's only fair and only right that this happens. So the main billing, the main guest we've got is Colonel Arnell David from the US Army. He was actually on the first episode of season one and is closing out season two. He is definitely a crowd favorite and he's currently doing an amazing job over at NATO Shape, so the Supreme Headquarters for Allied Power in Europe. His job role is like the job role of dreams, Strategic Initiatives Group Director, which is like basically come up with a cool project, cool idea, and Arnell make it happen. And very much that is the premise of the conversation today. He's also in his spare time doing his PhD, all about theory about prototyping warfare and the importance of it. And we really dig into that PhD concept, really explore his ideas, his research, and work out how it will and should affect the future of training and even potentially warfare. So really, really fascinating. Now, I will say, as a health warning that comes with it, a lot of people listen to podcasts in 1.5 times in order to get through them quicker because, you know, people like to enjoy it at different speeds. Now, with Arnell, it might be worth going at 0.5 speed for the start. Some amazing gems of wisdom that come out there, but just there's my health warning. So, Colin, before we speak to Arnell, we've also got a returning guest. Would you like to introduce him?
Some of our listeners might be wondering who the shadowy characters are that keep this podcast on the road. but please say he's not so shadowy. He's actually a guy called Matt Tutor, who's the campaign and contract director for the Crucible Consortia. That includes such companies you may never have heard of, like Accenture, McKinsey, Jacobs, CAE, all sound like pretty high-performing organizations. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised he's the busiest man in NATO. But what's fascinating is for Matt to give us a bit of reflection on some of the topics we covered, give us a scorecard, and also how that's affected their thinking and how rapidly things are evolving in the world.
Right, should we go and get our homework, Mark, then?
Let's do it.
Look, this has been the end of yet another season, and Colin said we'd never get past season one, so I'm very much happy to see that we're past now getting to the end of season two.
Yeah, Tom, look, I think it's been an amazing season. Such a varied and valued set of guests. Yeah, if anything really stood out for me, I think that's a hard ask because, as I've just said, there have been some massively smart guests and such sort of relevant and burning topics. But I really liked CAE's senior director, Jenny McArdle. And the great line that really stuck with me was, it's really useful to look backwards, to look forwards. And she was talking about the Cold War, specifically around how it required the US and its allies to entirely rethink their approach to training. The pace of technological change back then inspired a series of shifts in the US approach, you know, from Top Gun to Air Force's Red Flag exercise to the National Training Center, MILES program, etc. And all of that resulted in technological and organizational changes as part of a full training transformation. And I really think this is so relevant because we sit on this precipice right now of another, you know, substantial epoch of full training transformation. But this time, it's almost more intense, more rapid, more agility required. And yeah, we will not have the luxury of time to respond after that sort of first sortie, that first mission is launched by the enemy. We need to perform in relative peacetime to deter and, if necessary, fight and then win. So I think it's really good that training is becoming that sort of surrogate for warfare, hopefully forged in high-performing teams, irrespective of what the operational deployment is.
Reflecting back on that, the chat was just such a deep and fulfilling chat because she's just so knowledgeable and passionate about it. And for anyone that wants to go back to listen to that, the link will be in the show notes and I very much highly recommend it.
Yeah, and indeed, whilst Jenny's was brilliant, let's not forget some other fantastic contributors as well. Cubic's Andy Gales talking about the indispensability of TES for after-action review. I thought that really stood out. Ethan Wilson of Plexus describing huge technical depth, the vital role of modeling and simulation in recreating, capturing, and countering grey zone activity. So some really great material there, and enduring material too.
obviously we kicked off the podcast with the introduction to Team Crucible, which I was honoured and grateful for all the snacks I had at your launch event. And Tom reminds me that I'm kind of the guy to attend any event, and I did one the other week and Tom wasn't invited and I was, but that's just how it rolls.
You said, weren't you, you were like, oh Tom, weren't you invited? I didn't realise. No. I can't believe it.
You know, I don't know why, but I get invited, but we're very grateful. But tell us a bit about how Crucible and your role has evolved.
Look, a lot's gone on, and I'll reflect on that in a minute with the actual ACTS. I think the competition is moving forward against a series of challenges, and that, yeah, it's really clear to me that there's a desire to get it absolutely right. And then you reflect against the dynamic of the last 9 months since I was brought on to lead Team Crucible. What's happened in the world? Well, Russians have opened up a new offensive flank in northern Ukraine with 80,000 soldiers, the size of the British Army, making considerable ground. Clearly, they've been able to adapt their tactics quickly and dynamically, learning perhaps from last year's campaign and applying those lessons into their tactical doctrine, but also instigating the relevant training in their secure home bases really rapidly. Perhaps a lesson for us. Yeah, the Russians, they're demonstrating that they've adapted sufficiently to be different within a year cycle. Can we learn to adapt to this emerging and ever-changing threat dynamic faster than that to maintain our advantage? I was at a conference with a number of people in the US, and General Gervais, the US Deputy Commanding General of TRADOC, said recently that we've got to develop and maintain the ability to sense, process and decide, and the quickest party that can achieve that will win. And the challenge is then to accurately represent the operating environment. For her, one of her principal points was any LVC major exercise takes 180 days, by which time the Russians may have reconfigured and gone again.
It's interesting that, so we've covered quite a lot in the season about sort of realism and getting training right, but do you think there's a trade-off there about adaptability and speed of delivering training as opposed to getting everything training objective perfect in this? You know, I wonder if that changed your view on life in the last 9 months.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. Let's take the example in Gaza, where over the last 2 months, we've seen the US build and open up an entire inshore gateway under difficult and, again, dynamic circumstances. Imagine what that could mean for some of our logistics brigades, British Army's 102, for example. Can you create an immersive, adaptable, scalable and practical environment that would enable them to prepare and remain agile enough for a challenge that has multiple dimensional injects, CRAM on the beaches, complex NGO interactions on the beachhead, an ad hoc coalition, multiple displaced persons largely in desperate situations in a semi-permissive environment with two sides in conflict? And do that rapidly enough so that they can, as the US did, deploy from flash to bang in 2 months.
It's just astounding what's happened over those last 9 months, and it is ever more important, highlights the importance of getting things right going forwards. And to be honest, everything you've just said feeds really nicely into our interview with Colonel Arnell David from US Army over at NATO. So I'm so glad that these two chats are kind of married up together. Before we do step into that chat, Matt, is there anything you'd like to highlight or any kind of updates you'd like to give in terms of the contract or Team Crucible?
It won't be a secret to your audience that the British Army ACTS program has had a number of challenges in coming fully to market. There's been a down select following a PQQ stage, and we're awaiting the ITN release. But look, morale's good. Spirits are high. The rate at which the team works continues to astound me. Every day I'm seeing them pour effort into developing a solution that will help achieve the Army's vision to turn world-class soldiers into world-class fighting teams. You know, and at the very core of the Crucible offer is a digitally enabled, data-driven collective training system that will move as far and as fast as the Army does. It'll ensure that more soldiers can access more relevant, challenging training more of the time. It allows the Army to select, to procure, to compose the most relevant, reliable, and cost-effective solutions whenever they need them, regardless of the supplier. And that's why we're building an open platform-enabled ecosystem of partners that promotes a more diverse supply chain. So we look forward to continuing to do that and look forward to answering whatever challenges the Army presents us in the future.
Well, Matt, thank you for that little insight. I realise that the limits of time and commercial issues mean we can't really talk in depth. It remains for me to thank Babcock for their ongoing sponsorship of the Warfighter podcast. That is really appreciated.
Yeah, pleasure.
I mean, one takeaway is defence is full of good people that actually genuinely want to help.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of your point, and it's true, and that's been really uplifting for us to see. It doesn't really matter which hat you wear if everyone wants to see the warfighter do better. So without further ado, we'll move to our interview with Colonel R. Little David, who is in a new post and has some really interesting perspectives on training and warfighting.
Arnel, welcome back to the Warfighter Podcast.
Thank you, Tom and Colin. I've been following your guys' series and learned so much. It's been a tremendous benefit listening to your podcast series. And for me, it's a big honor to come back. Really, truly is.
Well, you know, like we said offline, it's very much the honor is ours. I think there was no other person that even crossed our minds to close off season two and be the first returning guest for the Warfighter Podcast. Thank you for giving us your time on a late Wednesday evening. However, there may be some people that are listening to this podcast who weren't around for season one and certainly your episode. So if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself and also update the listeners on what you've been up to in the last 12 months and where you are now.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Tom. So I'm a colonel of the United States Army. I'm an Army strategist, and I'm assigned to NATO Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, SHAPE here in Belgium, working as a military assistant and the director for initiatives group for SACEUR, for Supreme Allied Commander for Europe, General Chris Cavoli. Really privileged assignment, and I'm having a lot of fun with this job. It's busy. We're doing a lot of big things in NATO that we can talk to as well. I can highlight, but exciting times over here in NATO SHAPE.
When we were discussing kind of offline what we were going to talk about during this, and I just asked you what you've been up to, what are things that are keeping you busy, notwithstanding your day job, which, you know, it's a pretty busy time for NATO and surrounding areas at the moment. But you mentioned that you're actually currently working on a PhD as well. So once you then elaborated on what you were focusing on, I thought that was the perfect topic. So would you mind elaborating on the PhD focus and the concept that you're working on?
Absolutely. No, thank you for this opportunity to share my research at King's College London. I'm conducting a part-time PhD under the study of Dr. Robert Foley. He goes by Bob Foley. And I'm doing it on a theory of prototyping. To explain and to provide a background story, a couple of years ago, we were in a strategy session with General Sir Mark Carleton Smith, Chief of General Staff for the British Army. And I was telling him, he was asking me, what is this new Futures Command thing? It was a project I had worked on as the Chief of Staff for the Strategic Studies Group under General Mark Milley. And he was curious. He's like, why did you guys do this Futures Command? What's the big idea? What's going on? As I explained to him what we were trying to do, you know, prototype faster, look at not just things, but how do our concepts integrate to transition ideas into capabilities faster? He said, you know what? That sounds like prototype warfare. And we were stunned, oh, that sounds like a big idea. And he's like, yeah, go study this further and maybe study it further and pack it further to see if there's something there. So some of us did that. And we started to theorize about this idea of democratizing experimentation further throughout the British Army, allowing soldiers to play with stuff, really just trying to rapidly prototype things. There's another great story that, as I did my research and then continue to read about history, a lot of people, it got declassified in the late 90s, but the birth of our satellite program, our space program, General Bernard, he goes by Benny Schriever, he was prototyping warfare. He was prototyping in his acquisitions to build our first rocket that was going to take our spy satellite into space. And many people don't know, you would think that's this massive acquisition program that was all stitched up and very deliberate, but it wasn't. You know, it was a private-public partnership with industry and with some academics, and he was driving hard and fast and entering into a rapid prototype sequence where it took 13 goes. On the 13th time, they shot a rocket into space and they put that satellite into orbit so that we can have our first spy satellite taking pictures of the Russians and their missiles. And that's a pretty profound thing to kind of go back and look at, because if you think about it, these rockets are millions of dollars. Shooting 12 of them, and then his scientists are like, hey, just keep shooting them because we need to look at the telemetry data and the instrumentation to just kind of learn what's going wrong. Versus let's work at all the kinks and make sure the engine works and then shoot one. They just kept shooting missiles up and prototyping, but that's what it took to go fast. So therefore, my research, it's all about speed. Speed is the dependent variable in which I am measuring against the outcome of which for all my testing and experimentation and applied research to see how other variables affect speed. So speed is a big factor. I think speed is one of the most important things for us as we think about competition, warfare. So speed is the thing that we're trying to drive and increase. And I think prototyping can help enable that speed.
We touched on this, I think, in the first discussion. Yeah, your adversaries you're trying to beat. But actually, I think the biggest threat is technology. If the technology evolves faster than we can evolve, then we've got a problem.
Absolutely. So one big question is, do our habits of thought and process measure up to the demands of the changing environment? And in a lot of ways, it's no, right? Because in the military, we're very indoctrinated and we're very set on training against certain standards, procedures that we master. You know, therefore, there's sometimes anomalies that we might ignore And we need to, those anomalies, you know, are the essence of progress. And those are the things. So those anomalies could be technology. It could be a way they're applying technology in different ways, as we see in Ukraine. You know, you see those unmanned systems going after taking down ships. These are not really expensive systems that are taking down multi-million dollar ships. So these things are changing the environment, and we need to question our assumptions. And so that, like all theories, they succumb to the new facts, and they need to be questioned, and we need to question our assumptions about those theories.
Yeah, we were chatting about this. Like, if you pick one, pick the FIAC threat. We've known about this for a while. This is not a new, like, it's not unknown, but we haven't done anything about it because I think it challenges our doctrine. It challenges large procurement programs.
Sacred cows, man. I mean, that is the challenge. You know, you got to sacrifice these sacred cows. Right. No program manager's like, you know what? I don't think my project is relevant anymore. What are they? There's no incentive to do that. Another thing is like certain things like energetics, things that would change different programs, like just changing the speed and range of missile systems. But they're different programs. But it's an energetics thing. How do you do that when there's different program managers? How do we innovate in a way that you can do that? So a lot of acquisition processes are modernization's incremental changes. And so when we're talking about either, it's helpful, I think, to define the things we're talking about. So modernization, that's really incremental change to platforms, adding more armor on the tanks, you know, getting more speed and range out of a missile. But innovation, when we talk about innovation, the word that we like to evoke a lot, you hear it, everyone's talking innovation. That's more broader than the technology or tool or system or platform. It's an innovation is like where the combination of those things are adopted and then your organization changes so that you're adopting that tool or technology in a way that gives you an advantage. And that's innovation. It doesn't necessarily mean a thing. I think you can innovate by just reorganize your staff, make it smaller, make it faster. I mean, there's a lot of ways to innovate. It doesn't necessarily require platforms or tools, but...
And I like the example you gave of the, you know, the spy satellite program, because what you're saying is there were 12 failures. Like what we discussed in our first interview in season one, episode one, the military just doesn't like failure. An instant systemic problem, if you're wanting to ensure you're staying at the cutting edge and prototyping and innovating, if you can't bring in the acceptance of failure and the mature approach of, oh no, this is a step on the way to success. I've never seen that within a military organization thus far.
I'd be stronger than that, Tom. I mean, I think you're right, but I'd say we don't even want to attempt to fail.
True.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the first principles in the theory is like we need to increase our tolerance for failure and risk. And so how do you do that? You know, and I think that's why I think inculcating a mindset of prototyping might help, because the urgency back in the day for the Cold War was obviously existential. There was a need to try to outrace the Soviets. Sputnik happened and then boom, the United States was caught off guard. A lot of people were surprised, like, whoa, what's going on? Are they ahead of us? And so there is an urgency there, and it was existential for, there's that pressure, the conditions you need to go faster and harder. But it should still teach us a lesson of that there is a value in speed, right? The speed of acquisition, the speed of prototyping in a rapid sequence to deliver capability.
And would you say currently the Ukrainian military, they have already adapted this prototyping warfare? They have to, through necessity, have moved away from the traditional processes just because otherwise they won't exist as a country if they don't adapt and change. So would you say that they're already, you know, well on the way to this conversation?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. I think that if you watch what they're doing, they're integrating. I mean, I think it's what's gotten them so far, is that they're putting software engineers in their units. And then, I mean, that's kind of unheard of for us, right? We wouldn't have like software engineers, you know, in your formation, changing the code on your AI program that's handling the drones. And they're right there in the front lines. They're waving in gamers. I think you've seen articles where gamers are now flying their drones. And I think they've been very innovative in trying to, you know, adjust to the change of character of warfare that's in front of them because of what the Russians are doing. And they've been making changes that provided them an advantage.
Outside of Ukraine, US, UK, other countries, we don't currently have that necessity to adapt this rapid prototyping. So you talk about in your research of looking into how do we manufacture competitive conditions. Yeah, I'm keen to hear kind of your thoughts on that and how it might be actually practically implemented in countries and militaries that are not currently having an existential threat.
Going back to first principles, I mean, when I look at when I talk about a prototype, you know, this is like when I talk about prototype, I'm not necessarily talking about a thing or object. I think a plan can be a prototype. So one of the things I studied and did a lot of research on early on last year was decision-making. And what you'll find is that we haven't changed our decision-making process, the military decision-making process, since the 60s. So the theory that undergirds our military decision-making process is rational choice theory. It's very dated. Since then, There's been a lot of other theories, naturalistic decision-making theory. There's all kinds of theories that are like, hey, why would we not have, why is this not applied? You know, our process might be good for deliberate planning, but war fighting at speed, where we're in a competitive environment, will that decision-making, is it useful? And I found within NATO, and when I was working at the Allied Rapid Reaction Corps, we start experimenting with how fast can we get orders out. I mean, you got to give time to your subordinate units to plan themselves. And what we found was we were taking so long as a staff to get fragmentary orders to tell them to cross the river. And they were crossing the river before we could get them to order. And so therefore, what good are we as a headquarters if we can't get that to them? So when I say plans as prototypes, I think the wargaming and simulations, if we get repeated practice and lots of reps and sets, that can generate more of a playbook of plans, and those are prototypes. And therefore, your enemy's going to get a vote. They might not do what your military decision-making process led you to believe on your PowerPoint with arrows and bubbles saying, we're going to do this, the enemy's going to do this at this phase. We're very deliberate, and we have a prediction, you know. Again, we generate a theory about how, a theory of victory, how we might win. But then when we're met with the, you know, the enemy's going to get a vote, and our plans, you know, the famous saying from Loka the Elder, like, it's not going to survive contact. Well, it doesn't, right? Because then there's too many other variables to account for. So how do you condition your units to be more adaptive? And I think if you're prototyping your plans, making many of them, and how do you make many of them? Well, you have to put yourself into, you need to, like you said, Tom, manufacture that competitive context through wargaming simulations. And therefore, you create like a playbook of plans so that when your commanders are out there, like, nope, let's go to plan Charlie Alpha 2 because now look where they're at. They're on the hilltop. And we thought, you know, they're going to be over here. So let's adjust. We plan for that potentiality. We need to adjust on the go. And we don't need to go revisit and do our slow decision-making process again. You just go at the speed of relevance when you're fighting and switch your plans.
Yeah, and I like how this is the evolution of our previous conversations. We did talk about the playbook back then, and I like to hear your maturity of the thought process over the last 12 months or so. Now, you touched upon technologies, gaming, simulation just then, and of course, that's, you know, one of Colin and I's favorite topics. So I'm keen to hear in more depth what your thoughts are on training and simulation, or simulation specifically, has on this and what it could or should look like.
If you were to do more of that simulation in games and that data, because you get a lot of data out of different games, right? I mean, I know one of the games we were testing on Fight Club, a combat mission, when you generated the lines of code, it was like thousands of lines of code that, you know, you can start to interrogate that code and data with like how much 7.62 rounds were you using and how much was this? And you can start to look at that data over time. And if you have a crowdsourced game going on, we're fighting a lot of times and on that same scenario, it's producing massive amounts of data. And then you can start to glean some insights. Now, when you talk about the planning and integration of these technologies and tools, I mean, let's just talk about artificial intelligence. Everyone's talking about it. You know, we talked about that earlier. Everyone says they're doing it. Are they doing it? We there's confusion about that. I think there's a lot of space where, you know, I talked about decision theory. We're still using the old theory that undergirds our military decision-making process. Now, align that with the changes in technology, right, that have happened since the 1960s. We've had a lot of changes in technology. And I believe we misapply those technologies, the tools, the PowerPoint, the Word, Excel spreadsheets. We hurt ourselves trying to create a SIG matrix and a spreadsheet, do this, when there's plenty of killer tools out there that have machine learning within them that can make you go faster. So I return back to the first principles, like speed. Speed is the dependent variable that we have to measure against to see the things that we're changing. How does it affect speed? Speed of decision creates advantage. So I think the technologies that are present right now, there's many of them. I don't think these are 5-10 years from now. I think there's plenty of tools that you guys are well aware of, that I've heard, listened to many of your guests talk about, that we can take and apply. But again, there's going to be a tolerance for risk and a higher tolerance for failure, because it might not go the way you think. And then fine, we bend it and go on to another. We prototype. You know, we prototype the way we're going to play. We prototype the way we're going to wargame. And we keep doing it until we find the right answer and a better solution.
You've done a couple of one-pagers. I mean, that's really useful and really interesting. Going off our previous conversation about wargaming, when you pick things like Combat Mission, look at Command PE and Mod War Pro, which are things I'm really not familiar with, but have some understanding. I mean, ultimately, they are a form of virtual environment, but how are these things developed differently to what we normally would call a virtual environment, as in first-person shooter or a tank simulator?
Those tools you mentioned do a variety of different things. And our idea, especially, is kind of derived from the work we've done in the Fight Club, is that there isn't one tool or game to rule them all, right? It's a mixed method approach to study warfare and in all its complexity. And so therefore, we've been playing around and experimenting with those different tools. So combat mission, very tactical, company level, maybe battle group, maybe battalion, but mainly lower. And what it is, it's a constructive sim. So you control, you know, I think every maneuver leader, armor, you know, infantry, all your maneuver folks, they should be playing that thing all the time. Because, you know, I went to the infantry camp's career course, and, you know, we do a thing called a Right for Life, where you do an op order. It's very scary because you don't want to get a redo, because then you're rebriefing to, like, the chief of staff, a colonel, as a captain, right? And your odds of passing is very low. So this is a very stressful thing. It's a 6-hour Right for Life. You write this company op order, like your life depended on it. And then you brief it to your small group leader. And then it's like, you culminate, like, that's it. What if you loaded that op order and you played it out in combat mission, and you found out, like, hey, was my support by fire in the right place? Because maybe my systems were not ranging the objective to suppress it. And then I lost a lot of guys going into wouldn't you rather do that than go out into the, you know, go into the Unforgiving Crucible of combat and find out you didn't plan right? Because it's good to do your map recon or your map planning and use the different tools we have, but the simulation gives you a lot more fidelity on, like, what might happen, especially if they're physics-based. So same with the command simulation. It was mainly made for the Navy and Air Force, but we're starting to use it for Army too, because we're really caring a lot now about air defense. Air defense is really important in NATO, if you can imagine. So we can take the command tool, Command Professional Edition, and enter into it things you might want to protect, sites you want to protect in Europe. Like, so put in airfields, put in ports, put on your service-to-air missile defenses, put in Patriot, put in NASAMS, the Norwegian Air Missile Systems, a whole range of them, and then start launching missiles and see how do they interact, and do we have enough defense, or do we need to invest in more? And we're wrestling with that question right now in NATO, because, like, NATO is getting real serious about getting our stuff together. I mean, it's a whole new, I can't emphasize enough how much of a galactic change is occurring right now before our eyes. It's historic. I mean, I'm really, yeah, it's super positive, because I got here to shape. I was skeptical. I'm like, what is this place? Is it like the traditional NATO? Are you, like, you know, lead by 1500? And no way have any of those assumptions were true. There's so many of my peers and colleagues and all ranks and grades working super hard, civilians and military, to generate concepts, to generate the war plans, to test those war plans, to go after the procurement mechanisms to deliver those capabilities with the NATO. I mean, it's an exciting time right now. You know, we added Sweden the other day. I mean, I can't even talk highly enough about what is all going on in NATO, not just because I work there, but because I'm watching this unfold before my eyes. And it's a great time right now to be involved in this organization.
But there's a great figure in the document, because a lot of the pictures, but figure 4, it says lack of science, too much opinioneering, and no time for creative thinking.
Yeah,
so you need a Thursday war gaming, right? And well, that's all you do, like sports on a Wednesday.
Absolutely. Hey, that's a great idea, man. At the ARC, I think you're looking at a document there, an image that was produced and generated while I was at the ARC. And I studied it further last year as a National Defense University scholar. My research gets sponsored by the Office of Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. They're really curious about this decision-making and AI and gaming stuff. They're really intrigued by it. And I was brag quickly about the program there. Like, of 100 people that are 100 plus that started the NDU Scholars Program, only 7 of us finished. It's pretty demanding. So if you can imagine, that's why you see more footnotes to write that page. There's probably like 20 references. And it's that level of rigor of analysis. Like I said before, the quote of, you know, drinking an ocean just to piss a bucket. I mean, that's really what's there. Right? So what you're seeing is at the ARC, we found that our traditional wargaming of, and you guys, I think you guys are both in the service, right? So, you know, it was like, hey, all right, blue, what's your action? Red, what's your counteraction? Blue, reaction. You know, we did that. That was the old technique. At the ARC, we introduced these new methods and these new tools because we were trying to avoid the pinioneering. You know, when we did the older methods, people were like, well, the fires guys, what are you going to do about those integrated air missile defense or integrated, you know, air defense systems? Oh, well, you're going to smash them with artillery. Okay. Is that within the range? I mean, what do you have to shoot that far? Oh, yeah, we'll have air. We'll have this. And you're like, so it's opinioneering, right? It's like, it's not bounded by reality. And no one's trying to do wrong. Everyone wants to sound, you know, there's one thing about NATO and our different cultures, and especially the military, is like, no one wants to come in there and be like, oh, we don't have a plan. We don't know. What are we going to do about that? We don't have any capability. So everyone's trying to do. But when we introduce the science and the math and the rules, you can't just come in there and say, yeah, I'm going to shoot that far. Because you're a little icon of a unit. It tells you how far it can shoot. And then you're not ranging that far. That means that it doesn't go as fast as you think. And therefore, you're slugging it out. And what happened is we were learning so much from that wargaming that you're right, Colin, that the idea was like, let's scrap every week. If our core business is warfighting, why are we doing 100 other things in the week that takes us away from warfighting? So the core commander is like, I want this happening every week, all the time. It's not everybody, because like you're not going to get critical mass on this, right? Not everyone's going to want to roll dice and like play on a board game, moving icons, moving the different counters, you know, the units on a map for hours. So we did get is those that are interested, and then those that were caught onto it and showed up, they came in because they wanted to learn and they got better at fighting. And that was kind of the goal. So it's a great idea. I think all the units should kind of think about how, if your core business is warfighting, how much warfighting are you doing regularly?
And just coming back to kind of your big premise that obviously technology and wargaming is key to achieving this prototyping warfare. And apologies if this is a really kind of naughty question, but how, obviously those games are all programmed and therefore there's, you are always going to be bounded. So what happens when the Lieutenant so-and-so turns up and says, I'm going to strap a Starlink onto a jet ski and send it into the aircraft carrier or whatever, it doesn't matter, insert ship here. What happens when someone says that? And because all war games
need to have trade, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. But before Ukraine, if someone turned up and suggested that was a good idea and that's what they were going to do, could you model it inside those simulations, or are they still some elements of constraint in them?
It depends on the tool. I think some of them you can. I mean, we did introduce unmanned systems into Combination, DSTL. Some of our members that were at DSTL did some of that, and they tested out how would unmanned systems pair and team with combat units. I wasn't involved in that. I came as an observer to see what they're doing. It looked pretty exciting. They were looking at what behaviors would change. And so for instance, you know, as they were doing it, they're like, well, yeah, because humans are playing too in the game. And when they knew that was behaving like a robot or an autonomous system, they just left it alone. They didn't engage it. But what that did was, because it was at an intersection, it was fixing the enemy in a way that they were just like, I'll ignore it, but I'm not going to deal with it. They're not going to cross it, right? So then it fixed them in a location that allowed additional maneuver of your forces. So you're right to think, though, Tom, like, okay, so what happens if someone comes up with some, you know, a genius new maneuver or way of operating? And it really depends on leadership and courage, because our leaders need to be able to protect those mavericks that may have, like I said earlier, those anomalies, those things that are different and challenge our assumptions about how our core doctrine or our training paradigm. We got to protect those guys. And then those are points of departure to start researching further and begin a new level of exploration. You're like, okay, hey, good job, Lieutenant. Let's play with that more. Let's prototype that idea further and see if we can mess with it more until we figure out, boom, we might have an industry partner get involved, you know, set up another public-private partnership or some academics, and then figure out, maybe we can hone in even further. Then maybe you have a new thing. And I really like CGS, General Mark Carl Smith's like, hey, you know, our deployed environment, whether it's in Estonia or at the time, you had troopers in Ukraine with Operational Orbital Rule, he's like, our deployed environments should be a laboratory of experimentation. Like, why are we not testing these things out? As long as we're within, let's not go crazy. Let's take appropriate risk and not do anything stupid. But why not allow our units to take an environment where they're in, where they may have to fight one day, start testing out this kit, testing out different ideas? And I thought that was genius. And then that's where those ideas have really informed this body of a research.
I think I'm biased a bit because, you know, I've been involved in the virtual environments, but I think we call them digital war games that can actually achieve quite scale, because I think the problem with the desk-based board games is they're great for sort of going through the decision-making process and the what-if process. But actually, if you want to do, going back to Tom's point, if you want to try something very novel, the beauty of these systems is you don't have to model the whole thing. You don't have to build the whole thing. You could just model the effect and range, etc. And if you go, what if we gave every other infantryman an FPV drone? And you could say, well, that'll be a 40% effectiveness and whatever. You know, work out all the numbers and you run that.
One thing that my Fight Club mates have turned me on to is, like, I was never the hobby wargaming. I came into wargaming late, but they've brought me to better appreciate the manual games, because when you don't have those tools, which you may not have procured or not have at your unit, at least you have a game that has some rules, and it's a foundational wrap to build from. And you take whatever, it's a mixed method approach. So if there is an anomaly or, again, a thing where you're like, I'm not sure, like, I think I talked about last time with you guys, where there's that Royal Marine Major. He's like, I don't like that recce matchup. It looks wrong. He put it into another simulation and did exactly what you said. He started to manipulate the variables, put in different units, and he did it a number of ways. Like, he prototyped different ways of this happening. He's like, well, let's see if what we've planned is going to work out. He's like, nope, they got smashed. Okay,
That's what they do, isn't it? On the board games, they rewrite the rules.
Yeah, so they can white card it. I mean, yeah, it takes, again, a lot of leadership and facilitation, but how much are you going to white card? Say, okay, we're going to just say that happened. You maybe just want to get through the game and finish up, but I'd push people to go, hey, what would that look like? And then maybe bank that idea, park it, and then maybe someone go explore that later. Cut some soldiers loose to go mess around with that idea. Like you said, put in a simulation environment where they can test it and see if it works.
So let's fast forward. Now, I don't want to suggest, I don't know how long a part-time PhD while you're working full-time and managing family life, etc., will last. But say in a year's time, 2 years time, whatever it is, you finish PhD and ex-general sees it and says, that's it. That is the future. Let's implement it. I'm curious to understand what you think the organization would look like with a fully implemented prototyping warfare concept integrated into it. What would it look like? How would it feel like within a unit?
Ooh, it's a big question. Yeah. I would think that if they were doing the prototype, applying a prototyping mindset, and of course, it can't be everybody, right? Let's say you take an experimentation unit and you guys have some right now, right? And you have that regiment go. They're playing around with different tools and kits and ideas and testing it to where you create an innovation. You make a new unit. I think that's what I would like to see, is that by applying the theory in peacetime, because, like, again, it's maybe not wartime, hopefully it's not wartime competition that we're applying this theory, but you can. But in peacetime, you're prototyping new ways of operating so that you can adopt said change to create you an advantage. And that's what I would like to see. I mean, like we talked earlier, I think what's happened in Ukraine is an example of that, because they're forced to take whatever resources they got and whatever things they can do, whatever pieces of technology they can pull together. And they did get a lot of help from the West. I mean, this is unclassified. You could see there's a Time magazine of, like, bringing AI to war. And a lot of vendors turn up, like Palantir, and said, here, take our AI algorithms and technology, and you can have it. It's like the Starlink, and take all these things that come together. And what do? They generate a new way of operating, putting software engineers in units, flying, you know, drone swarms, using them to preempt a strike with other missiles so that their success rate of them going through to hit the ships is going to be increased. I haven't really thought about it too much, Tom, about, like, what does this look like at the end? And because I'm still got a long way to go on this journey, like you said, a couple of years. But I think that if I was to help, if the research I'm doing now, and, you know, this is why it's kind of nice to still be professionally working, because it has influence work at my day job. So as I studied Mokel the Elder and how they applied, like, a prototyping wargaming mindset in his time, we took that at the ARC and we were experimenting with the decision-making system. So we applied it. It's kind of nice because, like, I'm reading about these things and then I'm like, hey, I got an idea. And I've been very privileged and honored by generals like General Sir Edward Smith Osborne at the ARC, who's like, hey, go ahead and play. Like, if you want to go ahead and take a few of the staff and see how we can create a rapid decision-making process, have a crack, have a go. And then I'd come back and say, it costs a little bit of money. He's like, you can have it, get the money you need. It's important to me to see how we can, you know, operate faster. And so I've been living the dream of, like, taking the research and applying, having a research impact in the day job. And even till now, I mean, if I'm able to, you're reading and writing, it definitely bleeds over into your professional job, but it is hard. I mean, it's a tough balance to strike. I mean, the job I'm in is demanding. The man I work for is one of the most important guys in the world right now, trying to balance a lot as a combatant commander and as a supreme allied commander for Europe. So all of us are working real tirelessly to make sure that he has what he needs to inform his decision-making, because what he's doing in this alliance is pretty profound. His legacy probably won't be visible as we're in it, but I promise you, like, we're going to look back, like, this time frame of that these last couple of years and the years going forward are going to be a profound change for NATO because of all the work we're doing. And it's a real honor to be a part of it and just to weave in all these different ideas and threads. But yeah, I see units taking gaming, doing a lot of different games, and then that should feed the way that they might fight, so that they have Colin and his company is going to provide an AI recommendation engine algorithm, so that we're going to look for the, you know, all right, we got to do an urban fight in this type of environment. And you're going to punch that in and then it's going to pop up like, yeah, that game already happened. This simulation was done. Have a little play of the video. It's 5 minutes. And you look at it and go, okay, yeah, I think that's what we want to do. Let's move out. Let's try that. I think that's how the technologies come together. I mean, you see how kids learn, right? My kids are always, when they're at the dinner table, they can't help it. They're all gamers and they're all looking at, whether it's Minecraft or, I don't know, name the game, Fortnite. They're watching other kids play. And I'm like, what? It took me a while to be like, why would you, that doesn't sound very entertaining, but what they're doing is they're watching how they play so they can get better themselves. And so they're learning. And so another part of the prototyping of warfare is dual coding. You know, it's combining the visual and the text in a way that enhances your memory, your cognition, so that it's helping you memorize those approaches. And that's why I think the prototyping idea really works.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot we can learn from gaming. I was chatting to a lady the other week who was talking about voice pattern analysis. She'd done a PhD in this. And it's like, so this is interesting technology. So do you actually use this? She goes, yeah, I use it with the little team, whether they play Counter-Strike or whatever. And they,
really?
And wow. Just playing the game, they analyze the hell out of what they did that last hour. Because they're semi-pro.
I mean, can you imagine harness those lessons and how they're learning and into applied practice in the military setting or even in business? I mean, those are things that the gaming community, we know this from playing around the fight clubs, like that community, there's so much to learn. They're finding new ways to learn, new ways to operate, and enough can be said about that.
I remember seeing some stuff done by some flight sim hobbyists 15 years ago that I still think isn't beaten. The military still can't touch them. Now they're amateurs. They don't know what they're doing. But what they put together, if you walk in and you didn't know there were civilians, you would go, that's a damn good training system, a collective training system. The question I've got is, all of this, it's absolutely feasible. We can go and do it. The problem I see is, how do you get the commanders and the whole military industrial complex to turn around and go, right, yeah, we actually have to do that. If you take the idea of the jet ski with Starlink bolted to it, or the FPV drones, I think we're looking at it and going, that's really interesting. Yeah. We're not taking it seriously in terms of the way it changes our force structures. It's like, how are we going to take it seriously if it's in a simulation, if you like, your warfare prototype?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know the old saying by Basil Littlehart, the only thing harder than getting a new idea into the military mind is to get an old one out.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's right, isn't it? I mean, how do you do that? Well, what I would say is that you have to marshal the evidence for change. And if you, through the gaming and studying research and all this stuff, we're marshaling the evidence for change and saying, hey, we think if you put this many brigades against that, you play it out. We ran it like 1,000 times, man. It's a mismatch, or we really need to have an increased amount of air to attrit or to do this or that. It's all about marshaling evidence for change. And I would implore, a lot of our leaders who have the tenacity and courage and the conviction to try to just go for it, right? And having those leaders that may not understand what they're doing, but they know that we have to cultivate this kind of mindset within our ranks. What do we do in military? We promote conformity, right? When you're growing up and you're young, do what you're told. And then you're going to have some guy or gal go, hey, I want to try something different and do this. Well, I think we just have to, it's that increased tolerance for failure and risk and say, hey, go ahead and try it, And then when they do not succeed because they try something, we don't need to smash them and like ruin their career, right? You go, hey, all right, Billy Mitchell, we court-martialed Billy Mitchell, who was like predicted, they might leave from aircraft carriers and hit Pearl Harbor. He talked about aviation and the importance of like, he got court-martialed and, maybe he took the wrong approach, but our militaries have a rich tradition and history, like your guys'. I mean, when I was there, how do you change the regimental system? And good luck with that. Like, it's so strong. It has its own grace. It's a beautiful thing. You guys have some epic parties at your messes and your officers' messes, and yeah, I've enjoyed many of them. But they're like, oh, well, what if this regiment went away? Whoa. So it's really hard. So I would suggest that, how do you make potential? That's why I think the prototyping thing this theory of prototyping can help, is that if you're prototyping and you're generating the evidence and data and analysis and evidence, then you're providing the evidence for change. And hopefully you can convince a leader. And usually it's like a 5-minute video. Because if you go into like, oh, I'm going to convince you this change. We have 50 slides. Like, all right, going to sleep. You're not going to get their attention. But if you go, hey, we did a whole lot of work. I'm not going to bore you with all the messiness of this work, but check out the slick 5-minute video. It explains what we think is the change. Maybe you'll catch her attention. Because I talking to a lot of guys at the Pentagon that we're working on in the Air Force on like proposing a very big thing. They joke about making a big bet on like a platform, like an engine or something big, and for a jet. They did all this testing with Command Professional Edition, and they're like, "What will it boil down to? A 3-5 minute video that they're like, okay, maybe you're right." And you're like, whoa, because the trust is there, because like they package it in a way that it can land with our busy, busy senior leaders who have very little cognitive bandwidth to kind of read long reports or watch a or pay attention to a 100-slide PowerPoint. I mean, we got to get creative with how we communicate this change. There's got to be some psychology involved here and find incentive structures so that we get people to do this. There's efforts out there. I mean, I wouldn't say that we're complete shite at doing this. I mean, there's people trying and doing stuff, and you get some people with wins. And what do? I mean, we just got to tell their story and promote it. And then that by infecting others through example, we might get more success stories and more wins and more people trying stuff.
I'm reading a book at the moment called The Innovator's Dilemma.
It's a great one.
I haven't got to the end because I'm waiting. The guy is really interested because he's describing all this, and it's basically why big institutions don't change. And he says, actually, it's not because people are stupid or they're pig-headed necessarily. It's because they're making rational decisions. And the rational decision is, you know, in our world, is actually the aircraft carrier and the fighter aircraft work. Well, they work until they don't.
Yeah, it's funny. You see that you'll hear a story, and I think it's in that book, where Polaroid was like, they were like one of the first ones to invent a digital camera, but they're like ignored that, like, well, no, everyone wants the instant,
they invented it.
Instant gratification of
Polaroid.
They didn't question their assumptions. And therefore, when that came around, no one said, hey, like, okay, go take a team and go bet on that. And, you know, Google, they do this, right? They invest in like whatever their Alphabet or whatever. They take people and say, hey, go ahead. And if you have an idea, we'll put some money against it. Go play and see if something comes about. They take risks to see what might come about. They take lots of risk and say, hey, here's some money to, you know, let's spend 20% on.
Yeah, so there was a guy in Kodak who built, like, it was his little hobby, and he built the first digital camera. It's like everyone knew about it. It's like, yeah, but it's not as good as, you know, our wet film cameras. And that's what he was talking about, is the new technologies always suck a bit, really.
Yeah, in the beginning.
There's always a deficiency in somewhere, and therefore you can always not, you know, so logically speaking, they're not as good.
Yeah.
But at some point, there's that inflection point where they suddenly go, oh, right. But a problem is that at that point, everyone realizes that they're better, the new technology is better. It's too late.
And I suppose that brings it back to your point, Arnel, about how you communicate the value. It's how do you articulate that this new technology is good, maybe not as good as the current solution. However, look at the hockey stick thing. You know, when it gets there, it's going to blow everyone out of the water. So now's the time to be looking at it. And then how do you communicate that to senior leaders? Now, I'm just going to stop here a little bit. We've had a great conversation. It's, as ever, not surprising, really enjoyable. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. No, it's been, enjoy talking to you guys all the time. I mean, you guys have done a wonderful job with the series, and it is truly an honor to get back and be a guest.
Brilliant. And we'll hopefully put a bunch of links in the show notes to any of the research that's available.
There's articles that we've had done on this idea.
And Fight Club, and to, you know, Arnel's LinkedIn and everywhere. So they'll all be in the show notes. Well, thank you very much. And hey, no, who knows? Season 3 might be just around the corner, and maybe we'll get you back.
So, I mean, I genuinely don't know how he fits it all in. Does he do a Margaret Thatcher? It's 3 hours sleep a night.
My guess is that, because I know he's a very fit man as well. So he obviously gets enough time for the gym, for work, for family, and for his PhD, and the work that
really,
he's around.
You can really go off people.
Yeah, you can, can't you? I know, it's like, you know, the kind of people you don't want to spend time around just because you feel so insignificant next to them. And also, to boot, he's just a genuinely nice guy. He's always got time for you if you really want a bit of support, a bit of feedback on an idea. And again, those kind of people are few and far between. So thank you, Arnel, for your time. Right, I could get the smallest violin out now, Colin. This is the end of season 2. How are you feeling?
Yes, it's time for a pause, I think. We may announce something about season 3 at some point once we figure out what we're going to do.
Yeah, I mean, there's irons in the fire, and you know, things are looking good. Got to say, I think it is time for a break, a bit of a regroup and recharge. I'm ready to attack or reattack season 3 if and when it comes around. Colin, thank you very much for being a able co-host. These kind of things can be fairly stressful depending on the personality you're co-hosting with. And Colin, the listeners will probably appreciate that Colin is one of the most laid-back people you could probably spend time around. So cheers.
You know, to work with me, obviously, proper professional setting.
And this is a professional job. Jeez, Colin, that hurts.
You do. Me. Yeah. And Tom, we know that actually it's complete bobbins when we speak it, but you turn it all into something that's well-crafted. So I think credit goes to you.
Right. Well, listener, thank you so much for listening. I really, really appreciate it. We appreciate it. If for season 3 you've got some ideas for episodes, topics maybe we haven't yet covered in enough detail, then please do send an email contact@wolffighterpodcast.com, and we'll endeavour plan it for season 3. But until next time, Colin, speak soon.
See you soon.